Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Not Flash, just podcasts. Strike up the band!
Mushy peas for guacamole. I mean, you know, as if me.
I'm not an actuary, so, and they're both very old, so who knows?
I mean, that's just arrogant nonsense, isn't it?
Stop talking about it, David!
Yeah, here we are again then. It's how to win an election, your insider's guide to a big, big political year ahead. I'm Matt Cholley, joined as ever by new Labour mastermind Peter Madison, Policy Mackenzie, formerly Nick Clegg's brain, and Tory brain box Daniel Finkstein. How are we all?
Very well, thanks, Matt.
I've actually had some feedback on that from a former senior civil servant. He says he does not believe that anybody's ever called me Policy Mackenzie.
Really?
And I would like to say that they have, but not like as an active nickname,
yeah,
more as a sort of slip of the tongue.
Right.
Just getting confused, trying to talk about policy with a person called Polly.
I think we need to lean into it, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Do you find people are now coming up to you in the street and saying, hi, Policy?
All the time.
Since the podcast started?
All the time. Yeah, it's fame. It's tricky. I'm having to wear baseball caps and sunglasses.
Yeah, we'll lean into Policy Mackenzie.
I actually did get stopped on the tube last week by somebody who said...
Did you not got your ticket?
Thank you. Love the podcast.
Oh!
Love the podcast.
Great.
So one person.
That's all. I'll take that.
We also
that qualifies for a full focus group.
We also have at least one listener in Luxembourg.
Great.
My friend Lucy. Yeah. She listens whilst unloading the dishwasher.
Oh. Well, for 45 minutes. How many plates has she got?
It's possible she does some
Daddy,
other chores.
Daddy,
as well.
Have you ever
know.
Met a listener?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I've met many actually because our partner's I've been going around doing the book. My book and talking to various groups, people come up afterwards, and lots of them have listened to the podcast. I've been very encouraged. Actually.
Good. Well, if you're a listener, get in touch. You can email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. If you want to send us a question, we'll do some of your questions a bit later on. If you want to attach a voice note to your question, that'd be even better because we can hear your voice on the podcast. Then howtowin@thetimes.co.uk, and we'll do some of those a bit later on. Now we're going to talk about how to split the vote in a minute and where the Tory vote's going, where the Labour vote might go, and we've got some polling to show how people would vote if the Tories and the Labour Party didn't exist. But first, it's 100 days until the local elections on May the 2nd. Local elections are councillors and mayors in England, London mayor, police and crime commissioners. Do they matter? I mean, they obviously matter locally as to who's running your town hall. Danny, as part of your ongoing campaign to say that nothing makes any difference to the elections, do the local elections make any difference?
I think... You know, being a Bayesian, new pieces of information move my view. So the discussion we had last week, I think but both Polly and Peter
what's
were.
A what's a Bayesian? We all looked a bit confused.
It's about probability theory and where you start.
So taking into account
new pieces of information. So Polly and Peter made the correct point that actually these events, big political events, let's take, for example, the Eastbourne by-election in Margaret Thatcher's premiership. That was a contributory factor to her defeat, and naturally her being her internal defeat and her being removed as Prime Minister then made a difference to the next general election. So
Midstaffs and Vale of Glamorgan.
So I don't believe they influence the top line. In other words, I don't think that voters are paying attention or that their votes shifted by the event, but they do shift events in politics. So I think I would adjust, you know, my sort of general view that that lots of these things are noise rather than signal. They do have in effect.
So. And there's also just a practical point, isn't it, Polly, that if the Tories lose lots of councillors, they're less likely to be enthusiastically going out and knocking on doors and leafleting come the general election. There's a sort of foot soldiers problem.
A massive foot soldiers problem. And most councillors, except for parish councillors, get paid. And so they may actually be short of an income. I mean, lots of them are retired, but nevertheless, they might actively have to be working somewhere else, as well as the lack of morale and enthusiasm that they might experience for having, lost a position. Potentially, they might have to be, renegotiating the leadership of the council. So both morale and practical, doorstep hours are going to be really reduced by a big reduction in the number of councillors.
Third factor, in addition to morale and momentum, is the authority of the Prime Minister. You know, if they feel he's not a winner, then his authority further subsides and everything is made much more difficult. People are much more prepared to sort of speak up against him, create waves, create problems, not fall into line. And I think that will be the story of the rest of the year if Sunak, as he has indicated, he might go for an autumn election.
I mean, I suppose the counter-argument is Tony Blair used to lose thousands of councillors, dozens of councils in between general elections, and then would come back and win general elections. So they're not a direct... William Hague used to make big games.
It just seems to me a bit surprising that people wait for local election results or by-election results to tell them distorted... to give them distorted information about what the opinion polls are already telling them. I understand that it does happen. I can see it with my own eyes. It does happen. These things have an impact. They have an impact on morale. And obviously, if you lose a lot of councillors, a lot of people in the party, for example, have lost their seats and they've got to blame it on someone else. So they blame it on the National Party and the local MPs get spooked. But it seems, if the Tory party learnt from the local elections that it wasn't doing very well, why on earth would it wait until I can tell them that now? It's obvious from these huge polls, and we know it also from just talking to anyone in the street. So it's just surprising to me that these effects have, but they clearly do.
The other example, though, is 2017, where actually Theresa May did really well in the local elections. And again, because people are a bit weird and irrational, actually that led to a certain amount of complacency, I think, going into the actual general election.
Because they were about a month apart, weren't they? In May and then June. June was the general
which
election.
Is really unusual.
Yeah.
And one thing Theresa May did in that short campaign was announce what I thought was a very good, brave policy, but targeted to alienate old people, her core vote, which was to change the rules for domiciliary care, also known as a death tax or a care tax. I think she did that. I think lots of the motivation for doing that was we need to get a mandate for doing the difficult decisions once we've won.
And
it's safe.
It's safe
to say the difficult
things.
She
had such a huge electoral cushion
that
she could get away with doing something brave, as Polly says, like that. And look, the main problem with that election, as we all know, is that she called it and then sort of barely turned up for it.
This theory doesn't fit the data, sorry. it doesn't.
Danny always says about 2007.
I'm so sorry that I insist that it fits the data, but it doesn't fit the data. The Conservative vote went up. She scored more votes than almost anyone else has scored. What happened in that election was that the opposition vote solidified behind Labour. So this was about, and you've said it.
It was a rerun of the Brexit vote the year before.
It wasn't. I think the dementia tax, immensely consequential, and I agree with you know, Polly's idea that it landed very badly, but it's not an explanation of the result. It doesn't explain the data that the Conservative Party did in fact do better. It's just that Labour did better than everyone thought, because I think you're right, Peter. I think the European referendum was a large part of it, and the Liberal Democrats falling back during this campaign and not being as they had been at the beginning. People thought of them as the kind of repository of an opposition vote, and that didn't happen.
I just want to dispute with Danny one more time, yeah. In that perhaps it's too simplistic to say, oh, she annoyed really old people. But the reason Boris Johnson was able to win in 2019 is that he has one clear, simple message, which is get Brexit done. That's what Theresa May tried to do, and then
she was also facing Jeremy Corbyn, who by that time the penny had dropped in the minds of many voters, and they weren't going to have
the point. Moving on to, oh, as well as getting Brexit done, I also want to do a whole range of difficult things, and let's have a sort of operational plan for different parts of the state. That takes you away from a core focus on, I need a mandate to get Brexit done, which is what she originally called the election for. She came back from her walking tour with a vision of running an election that told that story, and then she got complacent and started to tell multiple stories. And I think that does harm the election campaign.
She barely told any
but
stories.
But her vote went up.
There was hardly
her vote did go up. And this is important in the splits that you want to discuss, Matt, because what happened in this election was the opposition solidified. Now, it could be that Theresa May ran a campaign. This, I would argue, was a big failing of the Conservative campaign in 2017. It did solidify the campaign. Now, one aspect of that could be people didn't feel strongly enough about the Tory narrative, that they were desperate, you know, not to defeat it. So it was all right, you know, an opposition force could be created, or people felt antagonistic to the Tories, so they solidified around the one force that could defeat it. Those are failings of the Tory campaign. But it is not an explanation of the Tory election result that Theresa May failed to get across to people, because although undoubtedly that's true from focus groups, it didn't affect the bottom line. No. So it's not an explanation of the result.
One of the things, we'll come to the how votes split in a moment. The other thing I want to talk about, because it's a sort of new thing that's happened since we last spoke, is that Keir Starmer has been given permission to start the access talks, which is where the opposition could start talking to the party in government about what they would do when they get into government. I just want, presumably you've all been involved in these things. Peter, you must
some
have
some more than others.
Yeah, you have, I haven't been.
Just sort of rubbing it in there with my two colleagues. Yeah. No, I was involved, one-upmanship.
Yeah.
I wear my access talk sort of medal in a robe.
Please.
No, it was a bit before 97.
Before 97.
But the point about the access talks is that they, you know, they fire the starting gun for the election. We know it's coming. It's election year. This is why Rishi Sunak was sort of reluctant to see this happen, because, you know, the moment the opposition starts talking to the civil service about what they would do in government, that sends a signal to the public that actually change is possible. And
how much do you share? Because obviously there's a risk that it could leak.
It tends not to leak. Yeah. I mean, the talks are very confidential. I mean, look, to begin with, the talks will consist of Keir Starmer and his colleagues explaining to the civil service how they want to manage a mission-driven government. So what Starmer wants to do is identify sort of five key priorities that bridge across different departments. For example, economic growth is the central one. Rebuilding the NHS, getting the NHS back on its feet is the second. Expanding educational opportunities, fighting crimes in local communities, and the net zero goal. Now, those are sort of five sort of properly, fully badged missions, and he wants the whole of government sort of reconfigured to get behind those missions. And that requires a lot of cross-departmental work. It will be quite a challenge, in my view, for the Cabinet Secretary and the Cabinet Office to make sure that government works in a different way to deliver those missions. And the second thing Starmer, I guess, will be doing is saying, look, you know, the central thing is economic growth. Without that, you know, nothing else is possible. I want a plan from you. I want to know from you how you think, what you think we need to do, should we be elected, that will lift the country up out of the sort of stagnation that we've been sort of going through, wallowing in for so many years. And I want to discuss with you a clear plan for doing that. And those are the two sort of pillars, I would say, that initially on which the talks will rest.
Polly, did you do any before 2010? Given the polls were close and there was at least a possibility of
access talks. Yeah. I supported the coalition talks, but not the access talks that preceded it. I mean, they were not extensive. The Conservatives had done, for obvious reasons, some really extensive planning, you know, month by month operational plans, which they had shared with the civil service, and then had a whole kind of a plan for the governing infrastructure around the changes to the strategy unit, the prime minister's delivery unit, mostly abolishing things that we shouldn't have abolished. But it is interesting, you know, the way Peter's talking about how do you change the machinery of government in order to operationalize a different kind of politics and a different kind of agenda. I don't mean just like changing the names of the department and moving a little team from here to there, but trying to think about so the Blair Brown era is characterized by this idea of new public management theory around targets and delivery mechanisms. I think the new thinking you're seeing in Labour, after the Conservatives sort of dismantled that without really a plan for what would come next. So that's part of what's going on in our public services. I think Labour are exploring a different kind of model that's much more influenced by mission thinking and design thinking. So I think that a sensible cabinet secretary, sensible heads of the policy profession will be talking to Camden Council, Georgia Gould, who is quite close to Keir Starmer, and they are pioneering a different model both of policy development and delivery. And that's the area which I think it will take the civil service a real big, big mental leaps as well as organisational leaps to be able to live up to what the new party wants.
Yeah, but you're not involved in any in 2001?
No. That was took place with someone else. I wasn't doing it.
Oh, so there would have been.
There was. But you know, I think they take varying degrees of seriousness depending on how policies, seriously people take the prospect. And it didn't loom very large either for us as a team or for the or for the civil service at the time. And, by the way, on the issue of whether or not, you know, the government should start it early and should delay it in because it's, you know, harmful of the credibility. I mean, this will, you know, the starting of the access talks will devastate Conservative credibility all the way from Whitehall to Victoria Station. Right? Nobody else beyond that.
Is that another thing which won't make any difference?
Yeah, completely not. And what it does, but it's very, very important for future government. So I'm all in favour. I actually think there are also mechanisms in place for the opposition all the way through a parliament, and it should be much more extensive. It should start much earlier. I don't think any government has anything to fear from it, because it's not one of those things that moves the bottom line, and it may lead them to govern better in circumstances in which they got into office.
This is exactly what I did in 2009-10. I invented my own access talks, and I had 6 months before the election regular private meetings with my shadow as business secretary, Kenneth Clark. And so important was it, in my view, that there be sort of continuity from what I was doing on the sort of economic and industrial front and all the things that I was doing, the initiatives, the industrial activism, and all the other things I was doing. So important was the continuity from one government to another that I agreed to meet Ken Clark every month in my room in the House of Lords, privately, to take him through what I was doing and why, and try and enlist his support. So that would, you know, go over into the election, should they become, in the unlikely event of the Conservatives replacing us in government. And that I did very successfully. There's only one thing he demurred over. It doesn't matter what that was. It was actually to do with Royal Mail, but the rest he signed up to. But then, lo and behold,
Vince Cable
arrived, with whom I'd had no discussion, who initially did all sorts of rather stupid things, including abolishing the regional development agencies, which they subsequently regretted. Which they regretted subsequently.
That was a Steve Hilton initiative, that one.
To by Vince Cable and Nick Clegg.
So I said
It was an innovation, and it was only possible to do that because of the relationship I had.
But then Kate asked Polly about that. And then obviously went in not knowing anything about that.
Can I just ask Polly about that? Which is, so what was the, were the Liberal Democrats involved in talks in government with a view to the possible involvement in a coalition, or was it sort of one of those talks that, in case they took over government?
No, I mean, the intention was to help us and the civil service to prepare for if there was a coalition. But a bit like 2001, but, you know, smaller. The extent to which that was really being planned for on either side was extremely limited. You know, in fact, as I understand it, Gus O'Donnell had done a series of sort of war games planning out what would happen in the event of a hung parliament. And they had concluded that the only thing that was impossible was a Lib Dem Tory coalition. So they were not really expecting us, though they did a bang up job of being nice to us.
Well, I'm sure we'll get into how to do a coalition, although it seems at the moment, if you look at the polls, unlikely, but we'll do that on another week. Let's up next, we're going to talk about where the vote is splitting. Where's the Tory vote going? You know, it was going all over the place as part of the problem. Will reform split the Tory vote? Could Jeremy Corbyn split the Labour vote? We'll do that next on How to Win an Election.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Good to have you with us. It's How to Win an Election with me, Matt Chorley, joined by Peter Manson, Polly McKenzie and Daniel Finkelstein. Right, this week I want to talk about where the vote splits and how you stop your vote splitting. Obviously, you know, if you look at the headline polls, you've got about 20% of the Tory voters from 2019 saying that they go to reform. And then you've got almost as many saying they're going to Labour. There's some breaking off to the Lib Dems and so on. But we asked YouGov to do some polling for How to Win an Election, asking if the Labour Party and the Tories didn't exist, if they weren't standing, how would you vote? And we took out the don't knows and the wouldn't votes. The Lib Dems win with 34%. The Greens are on 25%. Reform are on 22%. Any independent is on 8%. The SNP on 5%. UKIP 5%. Plaid 2%. And some other party on 2%. But what was interesting, I thought, was the way that the Labour vote almost all goes to splits to the Lib Dems and the Greens, whereas the Tories just goes all over the place. 18% go Lib Dem, 20% go Reform, 9% UKIP. It's sort of all scattered over the place. The bit that amused me was of the current Lib Dem voters, if Labour and the Tories don't exist, only 86% of Lib Dem voters stick with the Lib Dems, even though there's still an option on the ballot paper. Although somebody got in touch and pointed out, well, actually, maybe that's because Lib Dems are often the receptacles of wanted to keep the Tories or the Labour out. They're an anti-vote. Yes. So if they don't exist anymore, then they can have another view. So what should, Danny, what should Rishi Sunak do? Because basically his vote, they're only hanging on to about half of their 2019
votes. You can't see political parties as static. Obviously, it depends whether the political parties exist. And if they didn't, those parties would move to reflect the fact that there was an advantage. If there was no Conservative Party, for example, Reform wouldn't remain exactly as it is. It would either... If it did, and this is really interesting in your poll, it's pretty limited as a political force. In other words, that section of the right is substantial. It makes it hard for a Conservative government to govern, but it isn't big enough to govern by itself. If the Conservative Party didn't exist, they still would get 22%. The Conservative Party has a choice. In 2015, David Cameron moved in order to... allowed UKIP to still score above 10%, a point at which most people thought the Conservative Party could not win a majority. And he won one anyway because he moved into the centre and took votes from the Liberal Democrats. You can't look at these in a static way. If these other parties didn't exist, people would move. The parties would move. The Liberal Democrats move, you know, because they know what their political opportunity is in the seats that they're fighting. And the Labour Party's moving because it lost the last general election. So these splits are not... Yeah. You can't look at them in a static way.
So what should Rishi Sunak do about reforming Nigel Farage? Should he flirt with them? I mean, all this stuff about inviting him to be an MP or not, or...
My view is that the demographic represented... With Reform at its core, the demographics and the politics that it is involved in is limiting to the Conservative Party. If the Conservative Party wants occasional power when the Labour Party drops it, they want the Labour Party to be natural party of government, they want to reverse the process that Baldwin set in motion in a century ago, because Monday was a century of the first Labour government. This was pretty deliberate of Baldwin. He wanted a Labour versus Tory split, with the Tory party being the national party. If the Tory party wants to become what the Labour Party has been, limited by its demographic, associated with an ideology that's very difficult to govern with, it can, and then it'll do as Labour has done in the last century, govern occasionally, and then find that it doesn't govern for very long, and the Tory party, the other party will take over. So it'll reverse what Baldwin did. Labour will be the natural party of government. It can certainly do that. That's not the direction I've ever urged on the Tory party. You know, I want it to recapture its position as a natural party of government, and it seems to be moving away from that.
Yeah, I mean, what's made the last century a Conservative century in the main is because of the historic fissure between the Labour and the Liberal parties 100 years ago. And that essentially has divided the progressive forces, the centre, centre-left, half the population, and that has given an advantage to the Conservative Party. I think the Labour Party, from time to time, has given an additional advantage to the Conservative Party by putting itself, you know, too far left on the political spectrum, and it's lost a lot of support as a result. Now, the flip side of that is that when both parties, Labour and Liberal, are performing well and are strong electorally, and it's easier for them to exchange votes between them, then tactical voting can kick in constituencies. And that, of course, is, you know, the other half of the pincer movement that Rishi Sunak is facing. To his left, he's facing tactical voting between the Liberal Democrats and Labour because they're joined in their desire to get the Tories out, and both are have a moderate profile, both led by reasonable leaders, etc. So it's easy to exchange their votes between them. On the other side, to his right, he's got a sort of a potential split and a siphoning off of his vote to Reform UK. And that is the sort of pincer movement, the double whammy that Sunak faces as he goes into the election this year.
Polly, as an innocent bystander in this, what would you, the different ways of the party? Because I had a thing pop up on, I think it was like a Facebook memory. Must have been this time in 2015, the Labour Party was briefing it to set up a special unit to deal with the Greens. because the Greens were coming up in the polls in the run-up to the 2015. And actually, I think 8% or 10% or something of the Labour vote from 2019 is still going to the Greens. So both parties have to worry about this. It's a bigger problem for the Tories at the moment.
Yeah, and it's sort of a factor of our choice of electoral system. We have this first-past-the-post system dominated by two parties. And essentially, those parties have to become as wide coalitions as they possibly can while still having a kind of clear identity. Because, of course, the voters don't consider life in simple binaries, that there's only two answers to every question. In fact, there's multiple answers to every question. And the voters scatter into all sorts of complicated sort of demographic, political and ideological groupings. A political party in that kind of first-past-the-post system is trying to pull those people under a single banner and ideally scatter the forces that might oppose them. Of course, in a different electoral system, in a proportional system, you're much less able to do that because you also don't need to do that. And actually, it's much, in my view, better for the voters because they get to actually vote for the party that best represents what they believe in, instead of having to think about first preferences and second preferences and what's my place. And, oh, well, if all this kind of speculation about if Nigel Farage joined the Green Party and then the Liberal Democrats said something nice to Keir Starmer, and you're just like, ah, why can't I think about how I want to express my political opinions? And for there to be a party that champions that, I think a lot of people's dissatisfaction with the electoral system is that they are forced to homogenise complex opinions, and the parties feel the strain of this, especially the more sort of democratic they become in terms of being governed by their members. That tension between what the members want and the electoral need to be a container for multiple ways of thinking. I just, you know, we're stuck with it. It's a terrible system. But the best thing about moving to a proportional system is we wouldn't have to have this conversation.
Well, we would, because
we'd have a different one about coalition formation.
Yes, but we would. But it would be, it's the same conversation, really, which is, okay.
Of all the things to fall out about, I knew it was going to be PR.
No, I'm not here discussing with the merits, because clearly there are merits to proportional representation. Polly's outlined what they are, which is you can vote clearly for, as it were, your faction, but a smaller group that represents more clearly your view. And my experience of it, by the way, when I was involved in smaller parties, was that even then it was remarkable how often you ended up disagreeing with your political party. So
it's never the SDP.
It's never completely satisfying. Yeah. But let's assume that it's reasonably satisfying, or more satisfying than the current system. You are still faced at the end of the day with a decision, if you are a Conservative, whether you want to have a coalition with Jacob Rees-Mogg. That doesn't go away, that decision. And it just puts it off until after the election. It makes it possible for voters to control then which party they vote for, but they lose control of which coalition they enter into, which was actually a lack of control that Liberal Democrat voters really hated in 2010, and they sort of punished the Liberal Democrats for losing that. So they gained the advantage of being able to vote for a party and lost control of who the coalition was, whereas at least when you vote now, you kind of know.
Yeah, this is a completely sort of pointless theoretical discussion, because nobody is proposing.
Stay listening.
Nobody is proposing that we move away from our electoral system first past the post.
Well, they
anytime,
have any, do, don't they?
Yeah, and the Greens.
Neither the Conservatives or the Labour. But it's not going to happen. Look, I think we
in
should
a second Labour term. Sorry, Peter. Can I just press that? I think you're right. It wouldn't happen at this election. Let's say Keir Starmer wins a majority at this election, and the next election, obviously, there's a fall off slightly to the vote. It doesn't take much for him to be back in the position whereby he has got then to form not a coalition, but he's got to have a majority. He's got to have confidence and supply. You're saying there's no circumstances then in which the Labour Party would not offer the Liberal Democrats electoral reform to provide it with confidence and supply?
They might offer, in extremis, although I doubt it, another rerun of the referendum that we had on the alternative vote system, which is not strictly proportional representation. And that the Liberal Democrats extracted from the Conservatives as the price for the coalition. They then didn't sort of campaign properly in that AV referendum. They lost it very badly. The Tories sort of just jumped all over them, and it was just a disaster for them. And I don't really think the public are going to be in the mood for revisiting that anytime soon, but I don't rule it out. I think we should get back to the politics of this, which is basically the politics of Reform UK, which is an anti-immigration party. It's why Rishi Sunak is running scared over his Rwanda bill, because if he thinks that if he can just get one poor benighted asylum seeker on a plane, very expensive plane ticket by the way, to Rwanda, this will sort of see off Reform UK. I think he's deluded. I don't think he will, because I think that Reform UK
they are channeling. It's not just about that.
Hold on, let me make my point.
I think the
Reform UK are rather successfully, which is why they've doubled their voting intent. Performance in the polls over the last year. They are channeling genuine public sentiment about immigration. And that is why Rishi Sunak is running scared on this subject. And by the way, it's a real issue. I mean, for very many people in the country, particularly older white male voters who voted for Brexit, they thought this was the way to deal with the number of people coming into the country. They've now seen that Brexit didn't provide the solution, and they're very angry about it, and they're taking it out on the Tories.
But it's not just Rwanda that he's using to try and kind of show that they're doing something on immigration. They're also targeting a massive source of revenue into this country, which is international students.
In order to try and get some of the numbers.
Just because it's the only number you could possibly affect. And so university bankruptcies, who cares about those?
Keir Starmer has promised to do something about it too, by the way. The only difference between the two of them is he's not actually implementing his policy. He's not yet Prime Minister. But he'll have exactly this problem.
On the Labour side, I mean, they are holding on to, 86% of their vote from 2019. They're losing some to the Greens. Peter, two questions, I suppose. How big a problem would it be if Jeremy Corbyn launched a party? And how big a problem has been the backlash from the left over Keir Starmer's position on what happened in Gaza and his sort of full-throated support initially for Israel's response? That did upset some people on the left. Is there any possibility of leeching support to, whether it's a George Galloway outfit or Jeremy Corbyn outfit to the left?
Well, obviously, the far left and George Galloway and people like that are trying to recruit, mobilise party people behind them over what's happening in Gaza. No doubt at all about that. They've always done that with the Palestinian issue. It's a totemic issue for them. And they have their tactics well worked out. Now, does that translate into a new left party headed by Jeremy Corbyn? I don't think so. Because I think that Jeremy Corbyn has had his moment in the sun. His star has faded. The organisation that gave him momentum in both senses of the term, the momentum named organisation, has subsided and slunk away. He previously had the support of the biggest trade union, Unite, led by Len McCluskey. I don't see Len McCluskey's successor moving behind the formation of a new party. So I just don't think it's going to happen. If it did, I think it would get nugatory amounts of votes in the country.
Well, it's fascinating. Now, we'll wait and see. And I suppose at the moment, you know, if you just have to look at the polls, and Keir Starmer is in a very different place to where, you know, he was, 2 years ago, certainly, if not a year ago. Right, enough questions from me. Let's do some of the questions that you've sent to howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. Email howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. Darren from Sleepy Wiltshire emailed in saying, "Dear panel, great podcast. Keep up the political bants." I bet you hate that phrase, says Darren. Correct. He says, anyway, my question is, the best TV show ever is The West Wing. Is there anything you've been inspired by from the series or taken as an idea from it, or a storyline that has actually happened in UK politics? Or more generally, let's talk political. Are you fans of The West Wing? I couldn't really get into it.
Loved The West Wing.
I found it a bit soppy and slow.
I miss loving The West Wing. Does that make any sense? There's the sort of the Aaron Sorkin, the writer, hypothesis, right, which is that everything would be okay if people were just articulate, clever, and brave. And I'm sure that in my 20s when I watched it, and I would like stay up till 2 a.m, hoping that CJ would get together with that journalist whose name I've forgotten. And I loved it. I loved it. And I fell for that. And then living in politics eliminated.
You went to a Lib Dem. It wasn't bigger than Lib Dems. Wasn't the same. Lib Dem conference in Bournemouth wasn't quite.
Oh, look, no, but it was, I mean, especially, obviously, the experience of being government, but then the obliteration, really, of the Liberal Democrats in 2015 took all of that naivety and optimism that I had, and it crushed it. And so it's what's tricky for me is that I now, when I watch The West Wing, I somehow it feels like a sparkly golden fantasy, and I feel very much more alienated from it.
Maybe
than that,
maybe it was a lockdowny thing. I thought, I mean, I've got plenty of time to get into this. I just couldn't get it. Maybe I've just been hanging about politics for too long.
Too cynical.
Yeah.
That's possible. I became friends with Ron Silver, who plays Bruno in The West Wing. And I had this extraordinary evening where I had an evening with Ron Silver and Stockard Channing, who plays Abby. And it was sort of, I felt like I sort of imagined myself in an episode of The West Wing. And then I brought Ron into Parliament, and people were sort of slightly startled at this acerbic campaign manager. The thing about Sorkin wrote an article about what Obama should do in his election with McCain, and I realised it was terrible political advice. It was a brilliant script writing, but it was terrible political advice. And the reason is because, you know, normally Sorkin was able to script the other side's response, but he wasn't able to do that in real life.
Peter, you a fan, or what, have you got another political show you like?
I enjoyed West Wing because it exuded power, and I just revelled in it until the thick of it came along. And then I switched that sort of a terrible sort of parody of New Labour with all those sort of hapless ministers sort of falling over
having
their
to
own
resign
spin,
all the time, and
you know, getting swearing, getting themselves into awful sort of spin capers and spin mistakes and tripping themselves up over there, you know, and that sort of rabid sort of Alistair Campbell type figure in Number 10, that controlling
completely
monster.
Completely unrealistic.
I absolutely loved it. My favourite episode was when one of the more hapless of the ministers went on a factory visit. Do you remember the factory visit? So, I mean, how many times have we been on factory visits? Well, the other two haven't, but I have, because I'm a real bonin. And so he goes off and arrives at this sort of factory where he's making a regional visit, and he's greeted by this sort of screaming woman in front of all the sort of regional TV cameras, you know, who's a striking care worker, and she bawls at him. Have you ever had to clean up your mother's piss, you know, do you know what it's like, and do you know what I'm paid, and what are you going to do about it? And the ministers are faltering all over the place. And he gets into the factory, and he goes around the factory, and he literally can't think of anything to say about this factory. I mean, factories to this minister all look the same. Has no idea what they do or how they work. So he ends up sort of saying, God, what wonderful pipes you've got. I love the episode where
the policy that they're about to announce is nixed by someone in the office on their way, and they arrive.
They have to make one,
and somebody comes up with the idea that it must be compulsory for everyone to carry a plastic bag.
Yeah.
And that really just made me laugh.
Because quite a lot of them became real. The spare room database.
Policy so McKenzie will have come up with. Yeah, we'll have. Well, we've all been there. So,
well, you can email howtowin@thetimes.co.uk with more questions and your own TV suggestions. That was How to Win Election. I was Matt Chorley. Daniel Finkstein, Polly McKenzie and Peter Manderson. We'll be back next week.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.